Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present to you Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, The Science of Coercion, published in hardcover and softcover by the Oxford University Press, copyright 1994. Chris, welcome to our airwaves.
Thanks, Dave.
Let me begin, first of all, by thanking you for your work, not only The Science of Coercion that we're about to discuss, but also your landmark work, Blowback, and The Splendid Blonde Beast, both of which I've read and my audience is familiar with, and I think, shall we say, history or society owe you more than they're likely to be able to repay.
I think that's a little bit overstated. I think that I've been repaid pretty well. You know, your audience might be interested in another book. This is not a book that one would buy in a bookstore, but it is available in libraries and that sort of thing. It's a collection of declassified National Security Council records from the Reagan and Bush administration. And it gives a pretty good overview of what contemporary U.S. security policy is, in the words of the National Security Council and the President themselves.
The title of the book, again?
It's a ponderous title, National Security Directives of the Reagan and Bush Administration.
I believe I've heard of that. I believe I've heard of it. In any event,
it's a reference book. It's not something to buy in a, buy in a bookstore. But ask for it at a library.
Certainly, there is an awful lot to be researched yet about those years. And in fact, I think that, that research will hopefully take up an awful lot of literary space and time. Speaking of both, we have to move along here. And let's get to the subject of your remarkable book, The Science of Coercion. In this work, you collate two basic concepts or elements of contemporary American society, psychological warfare and mass communication research. Chris, why don't we start by providing a working definition of each?
Psychological warfare it first entered the English language as a translation and a mutation of a Nazi German concept called Weltanschauungskrieg, which means worldview warfare. And during World War II, the Americans built on that and expanded it and so forth, and used it to mean a whole range of tactics, wartime-type tactics involving propaganda, dirty tricks, covert operations, whatever, to carry out the war. Where it emerges into our modern reality came in the wake of the war, when more so-called peacetime type versions of essentially the same tactics emerged. For years now, of course, the government has told us that we're living in the world of no war, no peace. And what that has meant as a practical matter is that we're living in a world of ongoing low-level warfare. One of the early terms that was used to describe this is psychological warfare. Nowadays they call it so-called low-intensity warfare. Sometimes it's called, in a more polite form, public diplomacy, and so on. Just to build on that point for a minute, you know, when you hear people talking about low-intensity warfare, it simply means low intensity compared to nuclear weapons. Low intensity warfare, from the standpoint of people who are subjected to it, is quite high intensity, thank you very much. Some people would refer to it as total warfare conducted at the grassroots level. It's basically a form of terror against union organizers. I'm talking about Central America now. Union organizers, church people, community activists of whatever sort. In Central America alone, you're talking about fatalities measured in the hundreds of thousands. All right, communication research is the sort of ivory tower version of much the same sort of thing. There are schools of communication research at most major universities in the United States. Sometimes it's folded into the sociology department. But in any case, it is a box of preconceptions and of tools, preconceptions about what communication is, and of tools for studying communication. And these preconceptions and tools are used to train journalists, public relations specialists, television and radio personalities, all sorts of people, in college professors, I'm talking about myself now, all sorts of people who might be called ideological workers in U.S. society, people whose day-to-day profession it is to shape other people's ideology and ideas. Communication research is very much tied up with that because it provides methods for measuring how successful these types of ideological campaigns have been.
We should make the point that psychological warfare does not in any way preclude the use of deadly force, that the type of warfare that is called psychological warfare is warfare that is generated for the specific purpose of producing its primary reaction in the psychological field. This does not necessarily, however, imply that no blood is shed.
By no means. And in fact, from its inception, and from its earliest definition in classified government records, psychological warfare is defined to include assassinations, covert operations, guerrilla warfare, counterinsurgency, and so forth and so on. From its inception, psychological warfare has been the mating of violence on the one hand and what people would call today propaganda or communication, mass communication on the other hand. Another thing that's interesting about psychological warfare, from its inception, it has also targeted the people of the United States. The common preconception is as well, you know, for better or worse, this is something that we do to them. Or words to that effect. But the reality is from the government standpoint, from the standpoint of those who were paying the bills for its development, the targets always involve not only foreign audiences, but domestic audiences as well.
One of the points that we should perhaps make just in passing is that, again, the illusion that psychological warfare does not necessarily produce bloodshed or is not necessarily very bloody appears to have contributed to one of the rationalizations that some of the people who bridge the gap between psychological warfare and mass communication research had used. They rationalized their utilization of psychological warfare by saying that this would lead to a reduction of bloodshed or less violent methods of coercion.
Sure. And there are circumstances in which that is true. And for example, if you have a group of a battalion of surrounded troops, and you can use leaflets and loudspeakers to convince them that they're better off surrendering than fighting to the death, then in that type of circumstance, psychological warfare can, in fact, reduce bloodshed. But that's a very limited part of how these techniques are actually used. The main way, the main application, both measured in terms of how often and how much money is spent on it, how much academic attention is given to it, the main use of psychological warfare has been the suppression of rebellious pro-democratic movements in countries that the United States government felt that it wanted to dominate, most generally because of the natural resources of the country, sometimes because of the geostrategic position. position of the country. That's what psychological warfare has actually been used for, and sometimes that's meant beating up union organizers. Sometimes it's meant death squads. Sometimes it's meant systematic training of police organizations. And of course, as time has passed, I mean, you know, it's been more than 50 years since 1945 now, and the science, if you will, has not stood still in that time. As this has become more and more sophisticated, new techniques have emerged to both intensify the violence and to divorce or to separate the sponsoring country or organization from responsibility for the violence. This was one of the big lessons of Vietnam from the standpoint of American security planners, is that you kept American troops out of the line of fire to the maximum degree possible. It's because there was a political price to pay if too many kids came home in body bags. So what do you do? Well, you send down the Green Berets to train and equip the Salvadoran police force, or their treasury police, which then becomes an organized form of death squad to carry out a quite bloody civil war in El Salvador that lasted for a decade during the 1980s. And El Salvador's is as horrifying as that war was, it's just one name on the list. There are many other examples like that that have unfolded over the last 20 or 30 years.
In your discussion of psychological warfare, Chris, you talk about white propaganda, black propaganda, and gray propaganda. Mm-hmm. Do you think it would perhaps be appropriate to discuss the role of some of these personages and institutions that are involved on the one hand with psychological warfare and on the other hand with mass communication research as perhaps a form of gray propaganda?
Sure. Well, part of what the book argues is that this area of academic study and the various schools that are connected to it and the body of knowledge that is connected to it, and most importantly, the preconceptions that are connected to it. I'm talking about communication research now, the preconceptions that are tied up with communication research emerged in very important part due to government psychological warfare funding at the height of the Cold War.
Chris, could I ask you briefly to jump in with a definition of gray propaganda for our listeners?
Okay. Well, to understand gray propaganda, you got to address white and black propaganda.
Right.
White propaganda is like the Voice of America, for example. White propaganda is, depending upon one's point of view, is like NBC News. It is information that is repeated constantly, that has the appearance of veracity, objectivity, naturalness, and so on, but which in fact has a distinct ideological subtext, a distinct set of preconceptions about the message that one is trying to put across. Black propaganda, on the other hand, is what most people would call covert operations, assassinations, insurgencies, counterinsurgencies, dirty tricks of a variety of sorts, sabotage, the Contra affair in Nicaragua, and then building on that the whole Iran-Contra business, and then building on that the whole business of the Contras in Iran and the drugs. Those would be examples of black propaganda. Gray propaganda, to get to your question, exists somewhere between the two, and it has characteristics of both. The most common type of gray propaganda is where the organization that's sponsoring it puts disinformation, misinformation, into the news media that news media that has the appearance of being independent from that sponsoring organization. A rather simple example of this would come from, say, if the CIA puts a, well, here, I'll give you an example I saw myself, is back when Libya was America's worst enemy. Apparently they've come down on the list of our worst enemies in recent years, but back when Gaddafi was supposedly the most dangerous man in the world, the CIA had a psychological warfare campaign to paint him as sexually impotent, as somebody who was had a variety of sexual fetishes and so forth and so on. Well, they planted this information as though it were truth in European newspapers. And then that's gray propaganda, right?
Mm-hmm.
The next step is that type of thing blows back into the United States and Americans' conceptions of what's going on. I remember quite vividly a cover story in one of the supermarket tabloids that presented exactly this story about Gaddafi at the time that Gaddafi was supposedly our big enemy. Like many psychological operations, this eventually blew up in the face of the people who were sponsoring it, and was exposed as having been a misinformation campaign. So that if you're sharp enough and if you care enough to watch the little details of the comings and goings of the CIA and people of this type, then you can see perfectly well what's going on. But for most of us, we don't have time to do that. You know, we're trying to raise families, we're trying to you know, go to work, get through the day, and so on. And so we get this barrage of information, fake information, usually from the media that takes on the appearance of being true. When in reality it is manufactured, if you will, by people who have a story to promote, and by and large, the manufacturing is done by people who have the money to pay public relations firms and so forth and so on to put their story out. Those of us who don't have the money to hire our own public relations agent and so on have a little bit more difficult time getting access to the media. Now your program, Dave, I know gets out pretty well, but fair is fair. I mean, the truth is that not too many people. Certainly, Dave Embry, compared to Dan Rather, it's Dan has got a bigger audience. I mean, you know, we just have to deal with that reality.
Oh, it certainly is. One of my favorite expressions is an old Turkish proverb that he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages.
Very interesting.
Chris, you talk about the interrelationship between psychological warfare and mass communication research as involving three major types of intersections. One, you discuss psychological warfare, or U.S. psychological warfare, as in many ways applied communication research. By the same token, much of the funding for mass communication research has come from national security-related institutions, and that this in turn has had much to do with shaping the post-World War II nature of mass communication research as an academic discipline. And you trace the genesis of this relationship to a number of different institutions which were centers of psychological warfare during the Second World War. I'd like to briefly read a quote from page 25 of The Science of Coercion and then ask you to develop this further. On page 25, you write, Virtually all of the scientific community that was to emerge during the 1950s as leaders in the field of mass communication research spent the war years performing applied studies on U.S. and foreign propaganda, Allied troop morale, public opinion both domestically and internationally, clandestine OSS operations, or the then-emerging technique of deriving useful intelligence from analysis of newspapers, magazines, radio broadcasts, and postal censorship intercepts. Old boy network had much to do with shaping the immediate post-World War II academic discipline of mass communication research as well as psychological warfare.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think you covered those bases pretty well. And one of the things that came out of that type of World War II era cooperation. Now, World War II was a particular type of war. I mean, you know, Studs Terkel wrote a book called The Good War, and I'm not sure that any war can be described as good, but the point that he was trying to make is that it was a time in which the country was unambiguously united for the purpose of defeating a clearly evil power. And that really has not been the case. Certainly, it's been a far more complicated situation since 1945. Anyway, so during the war, you have these networks of psychological operations specialists are created. Moving into the Cold War period, the networks persist, and for example, people who were quite influential during the wartime period, then some of them move on to be the directors and the senior scientists at the main foundations, like the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and the Social Science Research Council and so forth, which is a major source of money for sociological research. On the other hand, some of the others went into publishing, broadcasting, and so on. And here's a quote from Edward Barrett. Edward Barrett ended up as a dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and founder of the Columbia Journalism Review and so forth. Here's Barrett talking about where his colleagues from the Office of War Information ended up. As of 1953, he's talking now. He says they include the publishers of Time, Look, Fortune, and several dailies, daily newspapers, he means, editors of magazines such as Holiday, Coronet, Parade, and Saturday Review. I don't know how many of your listeners are going to remember Coronet, but once upon a time, that was quite an influential magazine. Editors of the Denver Post and New Orleans Times-Picayune and others, heads of Viking Press, Harper and Brothers, Farrar, Straus and Young, two Hollywood Oscar winners, a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, the board chairman of CBS and a dozen key network executives, President Eisenhower's chief speechwriter, the editor of Reader's Digest International Edition, and at least six partners of large advertising agencies. The point being here that not that all these people thought alike, and not that they were engaged in some big conspiracy or something like that, but rather that they had a common wartime experience and a series of common preconceptions about what communication is and how it was supposed to be used and how it could be studied and so on. That has had enormous impact on what we today take to be communication. Now, this word communication is trickier, or it's richer in meaning than it seems at first. You know, the root word comes from Latin, com and munia, which means sharing of burdens. The spirit there is in a two-way exchange of information, a two-way sharing of burdens. Now, of course, that doesn't mean the burdens in Roman times were necessarily equally shared, but nonetheless, this basic characteristic of communication as being as having a two-way character or a multi-way character remains true. And you see it in other words that are related to it, like a commune or communion and so on. But nowadays, communication, particularly the way it's taught in schools, but also the way it's used in commercial enterprises, has quite a different meaning. It means how I can tell you what to do.
Chris, I'd like to read very briefly a quote from page 62 of The Science of Coercion, which I think addresses the point that you're developing. You write on page 62, "As will become apparent, the dominant paradigm," unquote, "of the period proved to be in substantial part a paradigm of dominance in which the appropriateness and inevitability of elite control of communication was taken as a given. As a practical matter, the key academic journals of the day demonstrated only a secondary interest in what communication is," quote unquote. Instead, they concentrated on how modern technology could be used by elites to manage social change, extract political concessions, or win purchasing decisions from targeted audiences. I think that's a very different type of communication than the root definition that you've been giving us.
Sure, sure, that's right, that's right. And I think, now getting back to like one of the themes that we started with is that has to do with this interlocking relationship between that type of communication that you've just described and violence, and are they really linked together, or is this just something that I'm asserting? And let me give you an example of two examples of how they are linked together.
By the way, Chris, we've got about 2 minutes left on this side. The side of the cassette.
You're talking about the side of a tape, huh?
Right, then we have another half hour of the interview.
So I'll tell you what. Yeah. Why don't you just go ahead and turn over the tape, and then we'll get into it.
Okay, sounds like a very good idea. We've been speaking with Christopher Simpson, the author of The Science of Coercion, published in softcover by the Oxford University Press, copyright 1994, subtitled, by the way, Communication Research and Psychological Warfare. For Chris Simpson, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.